Hello and welcome to the Software Engineering Unlocked podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michaela, and today I have the pleasure to talk to Chigusa Grover. But before we start, I just want to tell you that I'm taking a short summer break after this episode. This means that the next episode will be live by the end of August. There are many reasons for this break. First, I really want to focus on writing the Codery book right now. Also, I want to reflect on the past episodes of the podcast and maybe spice things up a little bit this coming fall. Finally, life is too short to get caught up in a hamster wheel, so taking a break and enjoying life is super important. And after that, I'm back with full energy, bringing more wonderful episodes and also with a bunch of new dates for my Codery workshops. But let's get started with learning more about Chigusa Grover, who is a machine learning engineer at Twitter. She's also involved in many communities that strive to close the gender gap and bring more people into open source. In 2017, she won the Red Hat Academic Award for her open source contributions, so I'm super thrilled to have her on my show. Thank you for being here, Chigusa.
Thank you, Michaela. I'm so excited to be here with you today.
Yeah, I'm also really excited. So you are my first machine learning engineer that I have on my show. Normally, I talk to software engineers or maybe product managers or CEOs. So can you tell me a little bit, what does a machine learning engineer do? And how does your day-to-day work life look like?
Sure. First of all, I'm honored to be one of your first ML engineers guests on your show. And if I talk about a high level explanation of like expectations from what an ML engineer does. So in a corporate setting, the task of an ML engineer would be to bring the element of artificial intelligence to business logic. It would be their job to build models either from scratch or use off-the-shelf technologies using exciting, like already existing frameworks with an added layer of their own variant and tooling. They also help sculpt the format of the data that goes into the machine learning, training or prediction services. And not only they build state-of-the-art models, but they also help them productionize at scale, which is one of the key things they have to do if they work at big companies or startups that cater to millions of people at once. If I talk about how a day in my life looks like, I would like to say from my experience so far that each day is very, very different for every machine learning engineer. Some days it would be like endless exploration of data, trying to find patterns and curate some useful features, which I would also term as feature engineering. Some days we would try as a team to build a model from scratch for a specific problem or tune our old existing models to, you know, catch up to up-to-date data if they are working on like an online mechanism. Some days it would be like setting up experiments, trying out different combinations of features, using different discretizers, performing grid search on best hyperparameters, experimenting with techniques to fasten the training process, keeping up with the latest research by, you know, reading research papers, analyzing results from experiments, tying them to business product metrics, and so on. So basically, the tasks are endless, and a day in my life would look so much different every day.
Yeah, that sounds very exciting. So you are now a machine learning engineer at Twitter. How long have you been at Twitter? And did you start as a machine learning engineer? Like, did you interview for that position? Or did you somehow grow into that position?
No, I specifically interviewed for the machine learning engineer role at Twitter. And it's been more than a year and a half since I've been working at Twitter. I work in the ads prediction team. And I'm fortunate enough that I was able to not only interview for the role, and I also bagged this. So yeah.
Okay, that sounds really exciting. So, but have you been a machine learning engineer before you interviewed for that? Have you worked at another company? And did you do that already before?
Yeah, so the thing is, before I came to know about machine learning, I've done like a lot of software engineering and open source contributions. I've also worked at, you know, research institutions. And for a brief period, I also worked at Facebook, which at a very interesting intersection of software engineering, data science, and ads business. It gave me a great insight into how companies leverage data and fuel their systems, thus making billions of revenue.
Yeah, it sounds really interesting. So when I was working at Microsoft, I had more or less a researcher role at the beginning. And so I wasn't a machine learning engineer, but we had to do a lot with data. So we were analyzing data, we were collecting data, different kinds of data, right? So I looked mostly at engineering data, right? So internal engineering data, for example, commit logs and, you know, communication information and things like that. And so one of the things that I grew somehow into that position, right? So from a research background and to a software engineering background, and then because I had to work with this data, obviously I worked or I learned how to, you know, analyze this data, and it was also part of my PhD as well. But I think then machine learning is another, you know, is another facet of that whole thing, right? So I applied sometimes machine learning algorithm, but everything was out of the box, right? I never created my own machine learning algorithm or something, but I worked a little bit with that. So how did you make this transition from, you know, the software engineering to machine learning? Did you do a course, or was it really hands-on at the company that you learned that? How did that transition work?
Sure. So I kickstarted my journey by contributing to a lot of open source projects while doing my bachelor's degree in computer science. So why I took bachelor's degree, like why did I decide to do bachelor's in computer science, was something that my parents asked me. Like, my dad himself is a computer professional and he works for the government of India as senior technical director. And then he asked me to, you know, pursue something in computer science because he saw that inner spark in me maybe. And then that's where I started. But I mostly was, you know, contributing to a lot of open source projects and, you know, working with Faro, JavaScript, you know, web technologies, Android technologies, and so on. And with that, I also started participating in a summer program, Google Summer of Code, which basically takes thousands of students all across the world and, you know, makes them contribute to a lot of open source projects. And one summer, that was my second time in the summer program, I worked on a project called Suzy, which was aiming to build an open source digital voice assistant, just like Siri, Cortana, etc., but open source. So that's where something about, you know, natural language processing and machine learning sparked and interested me. So I started taking up some ML courses in university, and I wanted to do something further. And that's when I applied for research internships in, you know, National Research Council of Canada, Institute of Research and Development France, and got sponsorship from a prestigious international organization, which I'm very grateful for. And that's where my interest in machine learning and data science intensified. I ended up, you know, working with, you know, postdocs and professors at these research institutions, talked to professors, worked on a lot of research papers. And that's when I decided that I should pursue an advanced degree. And I graduated from University of California, San Diego with my master's degree, you know, with specialization and focus area of machine learning and artificial intelligence. And that's how my journey, you know, basically graduated from a normal computer science and a software engineering background with a lot of open source contributions to ultimately being a machine learning engineer. And that's when I said I worked at Facebook for a brief period, working on intersection of data science and ads business. And I also gained an interest in ads business. And then I eventually moved to Twitter to as a pure machine learning engineer. And it's been a wonderful experience so far. And I'm, like, obviously so much grateful for all the journey that I've had.
Yeah, it sounds really amazing. I mean, I heard also a lot of different countries, a lot of different cities, which reminds me of my time when I traveled a lot. But so you were traveling as well. You were traveling a lot. Were you traveling alone, or did you bring your family, or how was that period for you?
So during that time when I was contributing a lot to open source projects and research internships, I was also helping, you know, help bridge the gender gap. So I used to work with a lot of, you know, women who code organizations, women tech makers, and so on. And because of all these, I am so honored to have been felicitated by Red Hat as the Women in Open Source Academic Award back in the year 2017. And that award, you know, the global award and recognition gave me actually wings. And I started getting invitations from, like, so many different conferences and summer schools and so on, like all throughout the world, and I would like get to travel. And during all these times, like even to the date, I've traveled to more than, you know, 15 countries all alone, and mostly I go for work. And even within the United States, I've traveled to like most of the states. I've covered 50% of the states of the United States just for, you know, work, going to conferences, traveling, speaking at them, holding workshops, etc. And to be honest, if I say like traveling has opened my eyes in so many other ways, I get to experience different cultures, I get to meet people, and I also get to see how's the working temperament in different countries. And yeah, so I would say traveling definitely helps you. But yeah, these days the times are such that everything's virtual. All my travels are virtual.
That's true. Yeah, I'm really happy that I did my last travel in February, just
same.
Before the lockdown. Yeah, I came back and I was like, I'm really happy I did that.
Yes.
Because now we are all stuck, right? I canceled all my travel plans. I should have gone to so many nice countries.
Yeah.
And I'm really missing the travel. But I also, so you're traveling, and then for your internships, you actually stay a longer time in different areas, right? So because internships normally are like 3 months, or what is the time period that you did your internships?
Yeah, same. So in Canada, I did for 3 months, and same goes for France in Paris.
Okay. And then you also moved, right? So because I, for example, I traveled a lot, but I also moved to different countries. So I lived, which means I would say living is more than 6 months, so that you really have to open a bank account, you know, find a,
yes,
a proper place to stay where you cannot live out of the hotel, right? Because it gets too expensive. So I lived in the UK, in Canada, in the US, in Germany, in Austria, and in the Netherlands.
Oh, wow.
How about you? I heard also that there were like a few countries, right?
Yes, I've mostly grew up in India, and I've lived with my parents. And then I, as I said, I moved to San Diego to pursue my master's degree. And I've lived there for around, I would say, 2 years, and then, or maybe less, like a year and a half. And then I eventually moved to San Francisco. So living alone is, of course, a different experience altogether. But I also enjoy the freedom that I get. And yeah, embracing different cultures is what I like.
Yeah, I can imagine that. I mean, coming from India and then being in the United States must be quite eye-opening. I mean, I moved, the first big move that I made was from Austria to London and then to the Netherlands. But somehow, because it was all European countries, I thought, you know, it's all the same, which wasn't true, right? Like, so I got a big shock when I realized that people, you know, it seems like we're very similar in culture, right? Western culture and things like that. But then we are very different. Like the values, especially the values, were something that were really difficult for me. Like when it comes to things like going to the doctors and what the experiences or expectations you can have there, right? Or how they would, you know, what they would treat as a serious illness and not so serious illness. Those things, right? I didn't expect that this will make a difference, but it did. But I can imagine that coming from India and then going to, you know, the United States is even a bigger difference. How was that for you?
Trust me, I'm still scared of the United States healthcare system, that I haven't stepped out of my apartment since 4 months because I'm so scared of getting sick. So yeah, the cultures are, of course, like really different, but I value both of them because, you know, one is very close to my heart and the other is like very close to how I work and all. But I'm trying to, you know, pick the best of both worlds. And yeah, as you said, things might look same on, you know, from a bird's point of view, but when you go deep inside, but in the case of India and United States, they are completely different. And yeah, but the thing is, when I go back home, I enjoy that because I've always grown up there. So
yeah. And so in India, where did you grow up? Was that like in a big city or on the countryside?
So in India, I grew up in a place called Chandigarh, which is the capital of the states Punjab and Haryana. Like both the states share the capital city, and then it's located in the foothills of Himalayas. So it's a very pretty town, I would say. It's not super big, but yeah, it's growing. And there I went to like a proper convent school, like the Christian convent school, and it was like so great, like all girls convent school. So the life was so different. So so not something that I experienced, like the outside world was like completely different from what I experienced in that all girls convent school.
Yeah, I can imagine. So one of the things that I want to talk with you a little bit about is your experiences at Twitter, but also maybe at Facebook for software engineering practices and machine learning engineering, or I call it now data engineering, right? Or data scientists. So when I was working at Microsoft, maybe I was in a very specific situation, right? So I was one of those researchers slash software engineers, right? In this large software engineering team. And so all the data engineering and, you know, like research obligations were on my shoulders, but there weren't a lot of others, right? So we were always the driving forces, right, for those things. And then we informed like the other people that were doing the implementations, or, you know, like we were, for example, making the prototypes and they were doing the real implementation then and things like that, right? But what I realized that is comparing with software engineering practices, the practices that we had as data engineers, they were less sophisticated. There was less rigor, right? There were still a lot of questions on how do we test our data efficiently, right? How do we review our code, or not only the code, because the code is probably not that important, right? It's the data. And how do we version our data? And somehow those questions seem quite unanswered a little bit in this data science world versus what we have in engineering, software engineering world, where, you know, it's like a push of a button and, you know, like you have your DevOps chains that are automatically doing everything for you. How is that for you? Do you have like this software engineering rigor as well in this data engineering world? And do you feel also like, I felt sometimes like so a lonely ranger more or less, right? Because I was surrounded by a lot of software engineers, but then the data science task, right, were only on my shoulder. Maybe there was one or two other people that we occasionally talked about what's happening. But I guess at Twitter, in your team, it seems like you're a bigger team where there are a lot of people that you can exchange your ideas and things like that.
Yeah, Michaela, so in that, I would totally want to echo, like, software engineering practices are more like sort of a rigid, like if you know you follow the agile method or the waterfall software development method, you always have like strict set of rules, like after this you would do testing and if it doesn't work you go back to this step. So the rule book is like 1, 2, 3 and you follow like bullet points like straight up to the fleet. But in machine learning engineering or data engineering, as you said, things are not at all rigid because they are mostly trying to solve open-ended questions. There's no like a strict solution to a question, right? You always have to do a lot of, it's more of like, I like to think of it as science, where, you know, like a chemistry experiment, say you have to do a lot of experiments till the thing works. So that's why you cannot put like a time, you cannot time box any experiment because you never know, the model training would take 2 extra hours than what you thought of, or it would take 2 extra days. And then sometimes after running the entire model, you would realize, it doesn't work as I expected.
Yeah.
So you have to like rerun all over again. Whereas in software engineering, I think that the idea of open-endedness or the idea of ambiguity is less as compared to data engineering or machine learning engineering. Hence, it's easier to time box those things. It can easily be said, oh, after 1 week from now, I want, you know, this UI to be present. So it's much more feasible than what you set expectations or milestones in machine learning engineering. Hence, even our team at Twitter does not follow these strict, because I guess everyone in there is from a machine learning background. Like most of the people have PhDs or master's degree. So they very well know the how experimentation goes. So we are mostly allowed to, you know, free form it and deliver as and when we think the model is performing as per our expectations.
Yeah, that's really good. I mean, my experience was when I started and we had like this team, then we had a very, very great leader, like a wonderful manager that it was also a reason why I actually joined the team at Microsoft. And he absolutely understood the exploratory nature of our work, right? And the research side that we had, and that, you know, as you said, you cannot time box it. Like you cannot say, oh, we are going to solve that problem and in 6 weeks we are done, right? Because sometimes you don't even know if you are able to solve the problem, you know, in a good way, in a good enough way that really makes sense, right? Otherwise it wouldn't be research. And then at the very end of my time at Microsoft, we had like a reorg. And I got a completely different manager, and he tried to put us into Scrum you know, time frames and things like that. And I always had like to predict, you know, and he always had, but there must be a positive answer at the end, right? And it must work. And then I said, well, if I can only try out what will work in the end, right? Then this is not research, right? It's not a bold enough question if you know that it will work from the get-go, right? Or if you know how long it will take. Yeah, so there was a big clash between different, you know, ways of working. So yeah, interesting. So you are a group of machine learning engineers that really understand the nature of the thing that you're doing. Was that the same as at Facebook, or was that a different experience there?
So at Facebook, as I said, my role was not pure machine learning. It was like a mix of software engineering, data science, and ads business logic, and so on. So yeah, the working style was completely different. There, they followed like strict set. Oh, by this should be done. And, you know, doing like a strict pattern. Of course, that company is more advanced, like more mature in terms of engineering. So yeah, things were completely different. But I enjoy working at, I enjoyed like both the sides of the coin. So. But it depends on the role, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. And so how do you review, for example, your code? Do you review it? Do you work together with other people that they are looking at what you're producing, or maybe at the data that you're working on? And how do you test your systems? Do you have like a methodology in place there for doing that?
Yeah, sure. So for testing, of course, we have like different, you know, services that we use and different expectations that we want the, you know, the product or whatever model that we build to satisfy. And as I said, we have a team of like all machine learning engineers, and people come from like very advanced backgrounds. Many of them are very experienced. So they obviously help me as I'm growing in my role. So review process, they help. And then for, as I said, for expectations, we have them set already. And then we rigorously keep testing the model on different sets of data to see how it's performing and is it, you know, as per our expectations and so on.
And so now you're in San Francisco, and well, there's COVID happening right now, the pandemic. Do you go to the office, or are you all working from home now?
No, it's been more than 4 months that I've been working at home, and Twitter has been like completely supportive. They have provided, you know, all the budgets for, you know, setting up a work from home office, like home office and so on. And till date, they haven't asked us to come back to the office, and I don't think that's gonna happen anytime soon. But the good part is Jack, our CEO, he also announced like flexible working style, that is, you're free to be remote forever if you want to. So that's something that I'm really excited to looking for. Yeah,
I can imagine. This is opening up a lot of opportunities, I think. And so do you see any drawbacks? Do you experience drawbacks working with your colleagues, some collaboration issues that you're having because of the remote setup?
I would like to say so far it's good, but of course I miss, you know, a little bit of the personal interactions we used to have. You know, it's like going for a coffee break and then you meet someone and then you're just chatting in the elevator, meet someone, or in the lunch line or something. Of course, I miss those little personal interactions. But yeah, work-wise, it hasn't been like a drastic change because we've been able to collaborate successfully virtually so far.
Yeah, so everybody is remote right now, or are there some people back in the office?
No, everyone's remote.
Yeah, I think that helps, right? So yeah. if a few would be on site and a few would be remote, then it's probably harder. But now everybody is on the same, you know, has the same challenges. And so everybody has to work towards, making
like,
it work.
All
right?
The conversations actually happen on the team channel now. It's not like, oh, some of them are, you know, talking in person, and the people who are remote, they feel like, oh, fear of missing out. Did I miss on some conversations, like interesting ones? So, but yeah, everyone's remote, that definitely helps.
So I imagine, I mean, I feel like this, when I'm talking to you, you did so many things, and it seems like you're super ambitious and you were very, very successful with your way. So can you tell us a little bit about how did you get into open source software, and, you know, what would you say, like, for somebody at the beginning, or, you know, that wants to advance their career, what are some really good steps that you thought, well, these are some of those steps that really brought me forward, because there are maybe a few steps that looking back, you think, well, this was really like leveraging or boosting my career. You already said like this open source academic award really opened a lot of doors. Is there something else like that you said, well, if I would do it all over, this is exactly where I would focus my energy?
Mm-hmm. So I would like to share how I actually got started with open source. It's actually a very interesting story. So while I was pursuing my bachelor's degree, you know, as a normal college student would do, like back in those days, would visit the library just to use like, you know, the high speed internet and, you know, scrolling on the phone mindlessly through all your socials. So I was doing exactly the same. And that's where I came across a tech conference that was happening, you know, on social media. And they mentioned something about Faro. And when I hear the word Faro, like when I heard back in the day, like I only thought about, you know, monarchs of the ancient Egypt, and I could not relate it to tech. So, you know, that day I just went back home and I did a quick Google search. And that's when I realized like Faro, the P-H-A-R-O, it's an actually immersive programming experience and a powerful environment focused. Basically, it's like an IDE and OS rolled into one based on an object-oriented programming language known as Smalltalk. So I thought, really interesting. They have like a very interesting name. And then when I started reading more about it, they had like internet relay chat, like a chat link to join. I thought, you know, why not give it a try? So I joined the chat, but I didn't know what to post. I saw like lots of developers, you know, back in those days, IRC was the way that open source developers used to talk to each other. So, you know, gathering all my courage, I talked to a few people in my university who were actually contributing to open source and said, oh, you know, they said you could just go and say hi. And I read their messages and on the blogs. So I gathered all my courage, went to that IRC link and just posted, hey, my name is Chigyasa. I recently, you know, came to know about the word Faro and this programming environment. I would love to know more about it. That's it. Like, that was my message. And it was my luck or something. There was a mentor from China named Martin who was online. And then he sent me like a couple of links to the documentations. He said, oh, you should read through these. I was like, okay, I'll try the examples and the tutorials out, because the tutorials had, you know, links to basically steps to install it, you know, make some very small UI games, tic-tac-toe, and you know, all that stuff. So I said, okay, sure, why not? Summer break came. I was like enjoying at home. So I thought like, let's start it. I opened the link, and that day Faro 3.0 was, you know, in the works, and Faro 4.0 was getting like, you know, traction, and they were like helping in productionizing it. So I tried an example. Basically, I had Faro 4.0, and then I thought, oh, this does not work. And I changed the example, like changed some code, and it started to work. So I went back to Martin and said, hey, I was trying this example, and then I see this works in Faro 3, but not Faro 4. And for Faro 4, I had to do this change to make it working. And he said, oh, good find in the documentation. Why don't you go and open a pull request? I was like, what? And then he taught me about, oh, I should open an issue first and then submit a pull request. I was like, okay. And unknowingly, this small bug fix turned out to be my first open source contribution. And that's when I got the hang of it. You know, I used to, you know, not only trying examples, I ended up making my own games, like, you know, Contacts Manager and so on in Smalltalk. And then I got the opportunity to work on Google Summer of Code. For both times, I worked with the organization known as FOSS Asia. And then I said the second time is when my spark in machine learning and all interest intensified. So that's how, like, I connect my journey from, you know, being a normal student at a college, you know, trying to get through all the computer science classes, in the end turning out to be, you know, interested in machine learning and data sciences. So that's how my interest in open source started. And it was, I owe it all to my curiosity, I would say. And the fun fact is, Jigyasa in Sanskrit actually means curiosity. So,
okay.
Yeah. So I guess I would always want to say, like, however difficult things may seem, but if you try, you know, these days we have so many, like, just a quick Google search helps. So at least try to, you know, make sense of what you see. And yeah, curiosity helps.
Yeah. And what you were saying is what I hear very often people advise, that if you want to get started in open source, the easiest foot into the door would be to start with the documentation, right? Make some changes and improvements to the documentation, because it's it's a little bit easier, but you also get to know the software and to get to know the people, because you also said, well, there was this mentor, right? So you have to get somebody that gives you, lends you a hand, right, on your way into open source as well.
Yeah. So on that note, I would also want to say, in my spirit to give back to the community, I want to be a mentor now. Like, I mentor people in like so many global community like programs, like Outreachy, Rails Girl Summer of Code, Google Coding, Google Summer of Code, and even like locally in all these communities, because I feel like there were so many mentors that helped me during my journey, and it's my turn to give back. And regarding the ways to get into open source, so people usually think like coding is the only way to get into open source, whereas I think that open source is a way of actuality. It's a way of collaboration and project ideas and thinking. So I also do like different talks and workshops at conferences where I talk about different ways to dive into open source, like diving deep into open source. It's not all about coding. So there are so many other ways you can, you know, get involved with open source. And yeah, documentation is the one and the foremost.
Yeah, I think that especially for me, for example, there is this probably social aspect that's also holding me back from contributing a little bit, because, you know, I would get intimidated quite quickly, right? And then I feel like you need a little bit help to understand where you start, or you know, very quickly people could say, oh, this is a dumb question, or you should have known, or, you know, be maybe a little bit rude to you. So I think that knowing how to approach different communities and having, you know, a mentor that helps you can be very helpful. Did you make any negative experiences in the open source community?
I would like to say, like, so far my experience has been mostly positive. Of course, there have been like teeny tiny instances where I felt, oh, this is not the right way. For example, when I was a student and applying for Google Summer of Code, I would actually receive messages like from people, like received from like a couple of them asking me to, you know, apply for a different project, since they were also interested in applying for the same project, and it would create a clash because then the mentor would have to choose like which one of them like he should select. So, but I was very adamant because I was like, I was contributing to this. So maybe the mentor should just see like who contributes the most, or maybe who has the talent. And it should be mostly based on, just because you eliminate competition does not mean there won't be any competition when you go further, right? So you should have like confidence in yourself. And I think it does not come overnight. I totally agree with the social aspect of, you know, being hesitant. I've been in your shoes. Like initially when I used to contribute, like, No one other than maybe my father knew that I was contributing, because I was so scared to, you know, share with people and like, oh, that I'm contributing to open source. So even my, you know, GitHub handle was my first, like my initially, and then I changed it after a year because I realized the initials won't work. It was just like JG or something, because, and then didn't even have a profile picture because I was very hesitant, because I didn't want, you know, people, you know, as you said, judging. And I didn't even want people in my, you know, class to know that I was doing something like that. But later on it changed, so it just took me a couple of months to get used to, and after that it was fine. I had my like full name up there, I had my profile picture, but it just took me like a couple of months, I would say.
Yeah, that's probably how I get into Twitch right now because I started streaming, and it's also weird, right? Like you're streaming and you get to know what you actually have to do, or, you know, if you even like it or not. So I'm not announcing it a lot because I don't want, you know, a lot of people to actually watch. So I'm actually happy if there are only a few people on my stream, because I want to get, you know, used to and grow into that new experience, I think. And I think when I'm a little bit more confident, I will probably announce it a little bit more. Maybe I'm not even continuing, who knows, right? But I think maybe I can relate to that for open source as well, right? So you make your tiny contributions and you're like a little bit hiding behind a pseudonym, or, you know, just initials. And then if you're feeling confident, you actually can have that much more. So you were also talking about the bridging the gender gap. And so I know that you have been active in the Women Tech Maker community and also Women Who Code community. How did you get into that, and are you still doing that? And now you told me that you're mentoring. Was that the same thing, or were there different activities?
So I started off by, you know, volunteering at local Women Who Code and Google Women Tech Makers communities back home. And it initially started with, you know, sharing how I did my first open source contributions, or, you know, helping people set up their GitHub profiles and, you know, fork projects and so on. And then later on, I started, you know, holding workshops where I would talk about, you know, oh, let's build a game in Python and so on. So I did that, you know, there. And then virtually also in programs like, you know, Learn IT Girl or Rails Girl Summer of Code or Google Coding, I would just be a mentor, you know, if they had any questions or just questions in, like, not even technical, but how to approach them, you know, open source contributor or open source developer and so on. And I did that back home, and even here in San Francisco, I'm doing it. The physical aspect might have reduced because I have a full-time job now, but I try to keep it virtually. For example, I would join like a workshop at a conference or just go to like weekly coffee chats they have in around here, the city, and so on. So that's how I've tried to, you know, give back to the community, because I've been helped a lot by mentors. I thought like I should also, yeah, help the other way around.
You know what also would help, I think, if you would be open to share your interviewing experience, especially for machine learning. How can I imagine that? How did you, you know, you applied for that? How does a interview look like for a machine learning engineer? What were your questions and how did you prepare? And yeah.
So yeah, for machine learning interview, I would say this is a little more trickier than the usual software engineering jobs, because, you know, software engineering job interviews would mostly focus on data structures and algorithms. Whereas in machine learning, you're required, especially if you work in a big company, as I said, you not only build models on paper, you also have to help them productionize at scale. And for that, it requires engineering skills. So they test you on engineering skills first. They would ask you to, you know, implement data structures, algorithms, and all the usual shenanigans. And then later on, they would move on to, you know, specific machine learning questions. They would ask you what, you know, different kind of models are. They would give you a use case. And that for that use case, you would have to, like, you know, think from top to bottom, like what kind of features, you know, you have to go creative. What kind of features you would want in the model? What kind of model would work the best? Supervised, unsupervised, SVM, PC analysis, and all those feature importance, feature correlation, all these. What kind of metrics or what kind of loss functions would you judge your model on? What is the objective function you would optimize on? And all these things. So you have to be like very thorough with the fundamentals. They will ask you the ins and outs of it. That's what my experience has been. But I would suggest if you would have like, you know, fundamentals of machine learning clear, it would be like a very smooth interview. But make sure that you also have your engineering skills brushed up. Like you would have to know your data structures and algorithms well.
And so did you have to code? Did you whiteboard, or how was that at Twitter? How long was the process also? Like at Microsoft, I think it was a whole day, probably 8 to 9 hours of interview.
Oh, that's long. That's long. Yeah.
Yeah. That was really long. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember having 3 interviews of 1 hour each and with like 20 minutes break between each or something. So it was around 4 to 5 hours, not longer than that. Yeah. And between that, they also had like a round with with my to-be manager or to-be tech lead, where they would just ask like, you know, usual life questions or behavioral questions. They would ask me like, you know, what I expect from the job, just to know like if I'm the correct fit or not. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so was it all on one day, or did you have like a screening interview first and then you had this on-site interview?
For me, it was all in one day. I was actually approached by the manager of my current team via an email asking me to interview. So.
Okay. So you went straight to the on-site interview.
Fortunately. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's really good. And so now that you're a machine learning engineer, is there some career path for machine learning engineers? Would you become a machine learning engineering manager, for example? Is that something that exists at Twitter, or?
Yeah, definitely.
How does that work?
So we have like as a machine learning engineer, of course, you can grow on to be like a staff machine learning engineer, principal machine learning engineer, and so on. But if you also want to get a little more inclined towards the managerial positions, you can, after you reach a certain level, you can also be like a machine learning engineer manager and machine learning and like so on. So what a machine learning engineer manager, like machine learning engineering manager would do would be to manage a team of machine learning engineers. So that is something like, if that's the part you're looking for, like managing the team, you could do that. Or if you want to be like a pure engineer, you can also pursue that path.
Okay, so what do you think that you will do? Do you know already?
So far, I don't plan like my life like 10 years in advance or something like that. I try to take it, you know, step a day. But for now, if I see myself, I would, you know, continue the tech path as long as I can.
Yeah, that's also what I really like at Microsoft, that you didn't have to choose, like there was not like you're an engineer and then you're a manager as a next, you know, as a next step, but you had like this parallel, really technical track. I mean, it wasn't called staff engineers, but it's like principal, and then you would be like one of those technical leaders, right? So you could even become like, if you're very ambitious, right, you would be this distinguished engineer, for example.
Yeah, same.
You don't have to take over the management part, which I liked, right? Because very often in smaller companies especially, there is like, if you want to advance your career, you have to switch from the technical side to the managing side, right? So
yeah, this is something that I like too, yes.
Okay, so very cool. Thank you so much for being on my show today, for sharing everything that you learned on your way with us. I think it was very, very insightful for me, and I hope also for my listeners. Is there something else that you would like to share with us and that we haven't talked about?
No, I guess we've touched most of the aspects. Thank you so much, Michaela. It was like wonderful talking to you today.
Wonderful. Yeah, so I will link to your profile, to your GitHub profile, to your Twitter in the show notes. So if you want to see for yourself what Chigasser is all about, just look at my show notes. And so just have to say thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Have a good day.
Yeah. You too.
Okay,
you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed another episode of the Software Engineering Unlocked podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, and I will talk to you after the summer break in a few weeks. Bye.